Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the From the Vaults Rugby podcast. My name is Phil McGowan and this World Rugby Museum podcast will explore some of the greatest players and moments in rugby's long history, featuring first-hand witnesses, commentary and interviews with the people who've shaped our sport. This episode, we will be interviewing 2003 Rugby World Cup winner Lewis Moody about his life in rugby, what it takes to win the Rugby World Cup, and how he got the nickname Mad Dog. Right, Lewis, you started your career at Bracknell.
I did.
Tell us about that.
So a young man, or a friend of my, so my mum's friend, had a son called Matt Foster, and one day he came over to the house and said, mate, how do you fancy coming down to the local rugby club and doing some rugby? I think it was six at the time, five or six. I said, yeah, I'd love to. And being an only child, you know, didn't have anyone else to play with. So ended up down at Bracknell Rugby Club. And I think, you know, pretty much fell in love with the game straight away, diving around in the mud, trying to tackle people, trying not to do it with my face. But I was quite a big kid, so it naturally lent itself towards my strength. And that was it. I was absorbed in the game. I loved the club. I played there until I was 11, at which point I moved to Leicester because Dad's job changed.
Did you come from a rugby family? Did your dad play?
No, Dad never played. He was, you know, he was sporty. I think he was county pole vault champion. But he was a career businessman. He started as a 16-year-old apprentice, technical drawer, and then worked his way through his career. So, you know, that was his focus. And he was, you know, absolutely determined to reach the top of his chosen profession, which he did. And sport featured, but only as a young man.
Meanwhile, you're playing rugby. So what positions did you pick up, or did you try all sorts of positions at the beginning? Or?
Well, you know, so that actually very quickly, because rugby was full contact back then and they had positions and everything at an early age, I was a centre, so I played out in the backs. And I stayed in the centres until I was 17. And Andy Walsenholme, Brian Welford, who were two of my school coaches, both decided that, actually it was Brian Welford at a county trial, where I was trialling as a centre, decided that I clearly wasn't making the cut as a centre and thought it might be worth me having a try in the back row. And from that moment on, I was a six or a seven or an eight. And, you know, I sort of felt like I'd found my calling. So it was an inspired piece of coaching and decision-making by Brian.
And you studied at Oakhams School, which has got a very strong track record for producing rugby players. You were playing in the centres then?
I was, yeah. So I went to Oakham from the age of 10. Brian Welford, who I just mentioned, was my Gerwood's housemaster in PH. So he's also my county, then Midlands, various different rugby coaches through my time at the school, along with Andy Walsenholme, and ultimately getting to sixth form and the first team with Ian Dosser-Smith, who was a legend of the Tigers. And so he was my first team coach. So I was really lucky that I had an incredible group of mentors and people around me that were pushing me in the right direction. But my entire career at school was spent playing centre bar my final year.
And then you must have been on the Tigers' radar from fairly early on.
Well, I was. We didn't have the academy system back then. No. You know, we had youth team, 21s, Colts, you know, the various different derivatives of the third, seconds before you made it to the first team. So I went through that system. But it was only really when I got moved to back row at the age of 17 that I think there was any serious attention paid to me as a potential candidate for the first team.
And then within a year, you're becoming the youngest player that the Tigers have put on the field.
Yeah.
So that's quite stratospheric, isn't it? Going from finding a position to playing with some of the best players in the world at the time.
Yeah, it was. I never thought of it, you know. At the time, it was just another opportunity to play rugby, which was amazing. But yeah, so after leaving school, Dosser Ian Smith said, go down to the Tigers, see how you get on the first team pre-season training, which I did, which was terrifying. But watching all the heroes and guys that I'd grown up watching on the TV, John Owen, Neil Back, Graham Rowntree, Darren Garforth, Rory Underwood, all these guys. So 3 months after that, it was less than that. So I played my first game. Was it the July or the August? We had a European friendly competition at Welford Road, and I played Boroughmuir, scored two tries, managed to outsprint Ivan Tukalo to the try line. And I remember Rory Underwood just sort of waving me on. I thought, should I pass it to Rory? Because he's probably a bit quicker. But he was just like waving me in. It was amazing. As a schoolboy that had grown up watching the Tigers, gone through all the age groups, sat in the stands, cheering all your heroes on to run out with your heroes at the age of 18 as a schoolboy still really was amazing.
No sense of intimidation at all?
Yeah, of course. You know, I was totally human. You know, I was intimidated. Never on the pitch, off it always. You know, just these are my heroes, Dean Richards, all these huge men. I was quite a shy kid, really. I wasn't massively confident. The thing that I was confident about was my ability on the pitch. So once I crossed that white line, I was really confident. I could just play. When I was off it, less so. So rugby gave me a real sense of, you know, self-belief, self-worth, and confidence, which has lived with me to this day. And I feel incredibly grateful for that. I had those mentors and support networks around me that gave me those opportunities.
And then within a year of that, you're playing for the Colts, England Colts.
Yeah.
You've then got the challenge of trying to get into the full England team, and with the Holy Trinity standing in your way.
Yeah.
Do you feel that that stretched you as a player at a young age?
Well, I think just being at Leicester stretched me as a player, because there were so many incredible back rowers there, you know. So there was obviously Neil Back. We then signed Josh Cromfeld, who was the other, you know, the best seven in the world at that time. He had Will Johnson, Martin's brother, Paul Gustard, obviously, who's now Quinn's coach, Adam Balding, Peter Short, and then Will Skinner. And there were so many guys that were all quality, talented players that you were constantly pushed, which is why I think I played and trained the way I did, which some people would say you were such a keener or try hard, whatever. But I always felt I had to prove that I deserved to play on Saturday. So I had to prove that just by playing as hard as I could do every training session. So, and having guys like Backy in your team at club level meant that I knew what I had to achieve if I was going to play for England. And I got my first chance under Clive on the tour in 2001. And having had an unsuccessful time in 98, not getting capped on that tour of doom to New Zealand, South Africa, Australia, I made sure, you know, my mind was in the right place, totally focused on myself, getting my body right to play. And, you know, it all went right for me, and that was the catalyst to get me in there. Backy was injured, I was out of the game for a little while. I came in onto the bench. You had Martin Corrie, of course, as well, another great Leicester back rower. And I think because of the experiences I had at Leicester and because of the professional attitude with which we approached our training, that fitting into the England team, even as a 21-year-old, was much smoother because I'd become accustomed to that.
You've understated it a little bit there, but at times you displaced both Neil Back and Lawrence Dallaglio in the team.
Yeah.
2002, match against New Zealand. What do you remember that?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was my first real... The first time I really felt I'd been selected on choice. I never felt that I'd get selected at Tigers ahead of Backy, just because of the history. And, well, he was a really, really good player. 2001, 2002, I was absolutely at the pinnacle of my playing ability. I was, you know, quick, elusive. I was loving my rugby. And I felt that if anyone was going to give me a chance, it would be Clive. And that was exactly what happened. So Backy got dropped for the first game against New Zealand, which, to his, you know, true credit, he was the first bloke that came up to me and said, mate, you're going to be picked for this game at the weekend. You deserve it. Well done, ahead of me. And then the following game, Backy was brought back in. Hilly moved to eight. Lawrence was dropped. I was retained at six. And then, sadly, the following game against South Africa, I'd actually done it during the training against Australia and New Zealand in the training weeks. I landed, going for a charge down, landed on my shoulder and completely subluxed my shoulder, which meant I needed a shoulder operation. So 20 minutes into that game, I was pulled off. And then those Holy Trinity were reunited. And I suppose if I had any regrets, which there are very few, one of the frustrations was that if I'd have managed to stay fit during the course of that international, would that have changed the makeup or the decision-making that Clive had around that Holy Trinity? Because I was pushing hard at the time, I was playing really well. But, you know, those three individuals were particularly tight unit and complemented each other really well. So I'll never know, but I would love to have seen what would have happened.
You nonetheless made yourself integral to the team. There was more than four or five back row players that were playing regularly. You played in every game in the 2003 World Cup. And your career had coincided with a period of history where England were literally the best team in the world, which hadn't happened since 1920s, 1890s. And it coincided with you at the peak of your game.
Yeah.
What was it like to be a part of that?
It was amazing. And at the time, it just felt natural because Leicester, again, were a side that were at the peak of their powers. You know, we won everything. So I went from a team at Leicester where I never felt like we'd lose week in, week out, to exactly the same with England, with you know, six or seven of those guys from that Leicester team. And you rightly said, we were number one in the world. And I literally felt like we would never lose, no matter what the score was in a game, whether we were behind by 30 points, you know, clinging on by 1 point. I never, ever considered that we would lose the match. And it was a remarkable period of time, really. And, you know, under Martin Johnson, who just had such, you know, control and leadership of that team, he was a real natural leader. And even to the point in training sessions where, you know, if the coaches are asking us, we need to do more. And Jono felt it was the end because we'd nailed it. He would just say, no, like, we've done enough. We stopped there. And it's not because he was a shirker, but, you know, the polar opposite. He was all about turning up and grafting. But he felt that the team were ready. Why waste it by then going and doing more? You know, they want to peak on Saturday, so let's save that. And we had so much. It was so much enjoyment running out alongside Jono and Lawrence and my cat and Johnny, because we were all just hell-bent on one collective goal, and that was winning at the weekend. And we would do whatever it took in training to make sure we were ready, and then whatever it took in the game. And the trust and the belief that that instills in you as players is, you know, is quite something special.
2019 Rugby World Cup in Japan is taking place now. How did you maintain that confidence and that self-belief in the latter stages of the tournament?
I don't think we needed to. I think we'd proven that we could trust each other. We've showed time and time again that we had the belief to deliver when it mattered. And in those games, you know, the games that we played in the build-up to the World Cup, we'd gone ahead to New Zealand, then had to hold a lead. Then we'd gone behind to Australia. Actually, it might be the other way around now I'm thinking about it. My memory's so poor these days. But so we'd proven to ourselves in every possible situation that we could come back from being a long way behind and that we could hold on to a lead despite being pressured by one of the best, if not the best side in the world, in New Zealand. So we had just this innate ability to know that we could do that. And then we'd done it at home at Twickenham and away against all those nations. So yes, when things were tinkering and the pressure was coming on, we just had to go back to basics and not overthink it. We knew how good we were. We knew what we could deliver, and we just have to keep we had to keep everyone calm. And actually, sometimes it was about doing less. I remember as we got further into that competition, actually, it was about taking away sessions and just making sure that we were fit and ready, because we knew we called it, you know, money in the bank. We'd done all the training, we'd put in all the years, and we'd proven time and time again that we could deliver it. Actually, we just had to be fit and ready to play at the weekend in those final matches.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And did you maintain that in the final? Because the final was far more unpredictable than many people were expecting.
It was, but we were a far better side than the Australian team. And it was actually our own, you know, I want to say failings, but our own mistakes and things that made that game a lot closer than it should have been. But in hindsight, again, you know, when the pressure came on, we knew there was. I was on the bench, the most nerve-wracking time of your life because you're not on the field. As soon as I got on the field, all those nerves go away. You touch the ball, you're into the game. And with a minute and a half left on the clock, it looks like we're going to go to a deadlock and have to go at penalties at goal. Line-out's called to me. Tomo's got to make a long throw that he's never had to do all game. We've certainly not hit all game. And people are like, well, were you nervous? But we weren't, because we had just rehearsed it time and time again. We trusted in each other's decision-making. Benny called it there, so we knew he called it there because they weren't competing. And you've got, you know, George Smith, one of the world's smallest back rowers. He's not going to leap and contest the ball. And then the rest is sort of history. So a remarkable time in my life to be a part of that team with that group of special individuals, yeah.
Did you watch the World Cup final in 1991?
I did, yeah. As a teenager, sat in my house at Warfland's Oakham School.
Yeah, because I did as well. And there was a sense, a suspicion that England just couldn't get over the line. Mm. And it wasn't just rugby, it was other sports as well. You were the team that did it.
Yeah.
What did it feel like when you'd completed that mission?
For me, it was a lifting of a weight that you didn't even realise existed on your shoulders. You know, the sort of burden of a team, a nation, a coaching staff, families, friends, because we were the best side in the world. We knew we could beat anyone going into that World Cup. So actually, when we got there, without being arrogant, we knew that we were capable of making the final. And actually, if you watch the videos back and you see the end of the semi-final, you know, if you had that now, or teams make a final now, you see them all high-fiving and, you know, like we did in 07, because making the final was, you know, an achievement itself. But in 03, whistle went, game was over, we shook hands, we walked off. There was no celebrating, because ultimately the journey had been about getting to that final, because we knew we deserved to be there. And if we got there, we knew we could win it. That's how confident we were. It was a unique period of time. And you're right, you know, it wasn't commonplace in English sporting teams at that time to be that confident going into a side. But certainly the enjoyment I got watching the final in 91 with the Winterbottoms and the Carlings and all those guys, you know, I don't know whether it gave you added impetus, but it certainly inspired me to want to be in a World Cup.
I've got to ask you about your nickname, Mad Dog.
Yeah.
Have you ever watched yourself?
Have I ever watched myself? Yeah. What do you mean, like play?
Yeah, or your playing style. Have you ever seen it? Obviously, we've spent many years watching
it. Yeah, of course. So, you know, I never considered it anything.
It stood out, you know, particularly after the World Cup when England weren't doing quite as well. And England might be losing a game, heads are down, and you're tearing across the pitch, intercepting every player, chasing every ball.
Well, do you know what? That's just what I felt my role was in the team. I felt, I had a role that I could help motivate. And I always just felt that rugby was a wonderful opportunity. I got to do something I love. And someone once said to me, I loved watching you play because you played the way I would have done if I had the chance.
Right.
And for me, it was always about just leaving everything on the pitch. You know, I may not have got to play the following week. Some I got dropped, some I got injured, which I did a lot. Mm-hmm. But I loved it so much. And I felt if I could use my tool as an inspiration for my teammates or as a tool to get the ball back to benefit my team, then I would. And it was just, you know, rugby's a rugby's about teamwork, but it's about community, and you get so close with a group of players for just a short period of time, sometimes a long period of time, that you really will do anything for them. And for me, it was as close as you can get to that sort of battle mindset.
Responsibility.
Yeah.
Right. And then 2010, you captained England for the first time. What was that like?
That was incredible. I was very nervous. I didn't know whether I'd be good enough. You know, I was questioning myself. Like I said, I was never particularly confident other than on the pitch as an individual. But it was an opportunity and a chance to do something that was incredibly special, and to have the ability as a young man to be able to, you know, as a only child whose parents had invested a lot in me because they wanted to give me the opportunities that they hadn't had, to be able to tell your dad, I know, okay, you put me through private school, the academic side might not have gone so well, but look, you know, it all worked out all right. It was a really special moment, and I felt a huge amount of nerves and anxiety because also I knew it'd be putting my family, my wife, my kids in a position where they'd come under the spotlight more. You know, we were leading up to a World Cup in 2011 in New Zealand where the media microscope gets even greater. So to say I knew I'd be a wonderful captain, you know, isn't true. I took the opportunity and looked at it like I did everything and tried to find a way of being the best that I could do. You sat down with various different leaders and Jono and sports psychologists to try and get to that. And all I can say is, you know, I tried my best and I gave it my best shot and I enjoyed every minute. And it was a very proud moment leading that England side out for the first time against France away.
Right, I'm going to ask you about something else now, something that the two of us are both very interested in. You were the RFU's first World War ambassador.
I was.
For 4 years recently. How did you get interested in the Great War?
Well, it's really simple. My namesake and great-grandfather, my dad's granddad, was in the British Expeditionary Force, so the first wave of troops that went over and met the Germans in 1914. And I was given his medals as a young man by my dad's brother, Trevor, and obviously on it has my name, Lewis W. Moody. And it was that I was galvanised from that moment. I spent years trying to track down more information. Why did they name me after him? What was he like as a bloke? You know, what was... And actually, as you research, he had very little time over in France. You know, they had Mons, they had the retreat from Mons, which he was involved with, and then he was medically discharged very soon after that. He received all of his medals and the Civil War badge to say that he'd been medically discharged, so he didn't receive a white feather. You know, as sadly so many did, you know, that... from various ladies, but it's just a passion, I suppose, also because sense of adversity. You know, I loved the game rugby was a hard game, you know, and there's always adversity that you have to overcome, injury, etc., but I could never get my head around how on a daily basis, you know, you take a step and never knowing, you know, whether it could be your last, and you know, that trench warfare, the various different daily routines I had to go through. And then with the RFU in particular, coming into that role was just literally my dreams come true, because I spent so long touring the world with England, and wherever we went, any country, I'd always spend moments going to the various different memorials in each country representing the Commonwealth troops, you know, whether it's New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, etc. And that was my sort of time to just reflect and actually just escape what was going on rugby for me. And it was just always a hobby and a passion. So that 4 years and doing it with yourself, Phil, in the knowledge that you have of the England players and their histories, was just a wonderful experience.
27 England internationals lost their life in the First World War. There's stories of bravery attached to each of them. Does any one in particular stand out for you?
They do, because you get to know some, you know, the more you research it, the more you get to know the stories, but really you're right. There's so many. There's Oscar Schwartz, you know, who was a South African cricketer, came over, I think, and he had two caps, but he was an MC, survived all the major battles of the war, only to get influenza and die, you know, 7 days after the end. You know, there's Edgar Mobbs, really, who is just a remarkable human being. Signs up, wasn't allowed to join, signs up by taking the mic at halftime at Northampton, galvanising all the people in the stand, going down to recruiting office, ends up taking them regiment over, goes from a private to a lieutenant colonel in a year and a half, and dies trying to take on a bunker, was at Lone Star Post, you know, trying to take it out with grenades.
Yeah.
And, you know, but all of those stories, the ones that really stick in my mind, I have rose-tinted glasses around this story, but Jack King and Noel Slocock, in two different regiments, Noel Slocock's going off to France with the London Liverpool Scottish Regiment. Jack King's in the Hussars, and they have a chance conversation. Slocock says, "Well, we're going to France. Why don't you come over? Why don't you switch regiments and come with us?" Which he did. They obviously then fought in the Battle of the Somme, and the attack on Guillemot, and both died in that same attack on that same day. And part of me has this rose-tinted vision that they were side by side, you know, teammates, although they didn't play in the same England side, going over the top together. You know, I went recently back to the same fields, retracing their steps, and still the paraphernalia scattered around the fields. You know, live grenade in the side of the field, you know, German shell cases, entrenching tools. The war, it's like living history, and I felt such a connection to those individuals whose names were on the walls that we used to walk past as an England player, that to have had the great fortune and privilege to have gone and commemorated them and been a part of their remembrance was again, you know, a very special moment in my life.
Just extend that about the Jack King story to his enlistment. So he was a Yorkshire sheep farmer.
Yeah.
5'5", too short to enlist.
Yeah.
And what did he do? He stood in the recruiting office for 3 days, I think.
Yeah. Kept, was told to go away and come back and go away and come back, and he did. They said he wasn't tall enough, didn't they? I can't remember the exact story now. You probably remember it better than me. But finally was, I think, did he refuse to go eventually?
He just stayed there until they took him.
Yeah, point blank. I mean, that just shows how much. I mean, when you read about him as a player as well, they talk about this lion-hearted individual. You know, it was very short, similar sort of size to Neil Back. But you can just imagine the manner in which he would have gone about getting into the army, and then the manner he would have gone about being a soldier. And there was great articles written about, you know, those two in particular, and about what a loss it was to the game, but to us as a whole, because they were just such incredible inspirations. There was one about Slocock saying that, you know, if there wasn't much known about how he died from the war diaries, I think they have got destroyed during the Blitz, but there was a great article in the Roll of Honour book in the World Rugby Museum that says, you know, if Noel Slocock was to go down, then we would wish it was in a hand-to-hand combat, because that is the way he would have wanted it. And the images of him reminded us of the berserkers of old. You know, just you can just imagine this enormous man, the way that people imagined him on the rugby field, how they imagined him going into battle. But the reality is it probably was not like that, especially at Guillemot. But yeah, remarkable stories of just incredible bravery, but young men that, you know, that all played for their country and then gave so much for the country.
Lewis, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks for listening to From the Vaults. If you're not already, please follow us on @WRugbyMuseum at Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Sign up to our blog, also called From the Vaults, on WordPress. And more importantly, come down and visit the World Rugby Museum here at Swickenham Stadium. Please subscribe to From the Vaults for regular content like this.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.